Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Progressive Bitcoiner. I'm your host, Trey Walsh, and today we have on the show Ahmed Klink. He is the co-founder and director at a design firm in New York City called Sunday Afternoon, doing a lot of awesome photography and creative work and design work. He's also worked with the team at Zeus, one of our show sponsors, an awesome lightning product to come up with their design and story and all of that. And also, Ahmed comes from Lebanon, and we talk about his journey from Lebanon. He moved to France, and we talk about his journey in France and then over to the US. So a lot of this conversation is spent talking about Lebanon and talking about what Bitcoin can do in a place like Lebanon. We talk about kind of the Lebanese Civil War. We talk about currency devaluation, and we talk about Bitcoin being a product of hope for people in places like that, and the importance of Bitcoin as an open protocol and better sound money. And that's the bulk of what we spend our conversation on. And I want to thank Ahmed for coming on the show. And as we say in the show, if you want to connect with Ahmed, if you have a Bitcoin product or business and you want to work with some awesome creatives and storytellers, definitely feel free to reach out to Ahmed, and you'll be able to find that in the show notes as well. And as always, if you have any questions or feedback about the show, you can hit me up in our Telegram group, and you can also email me at hello@progressivebitcoiner.com. And don't forget about our show sponsors and all of those promo links in the show notes for Bitbox, Saz Mining, and Zeus. And I want to thank all of those awesome products for being partners with us on this show. And as always, don't forget about our Substack as well for our weekly newsletter. And we have our paid Substack as well for you to check out all of those extra benefits to get access to via our Substack. And you can also check out our Geyser Fund. And now we have a reward that if you want access to our Substack as a paid member, but you want to pay in Bitcoin, you can go on our Geyser Fund and do that. There's a reward option for that now. And shout out for the team at Geyser, who's been doing awesome work to create that platform that we've been utilizing quite a bit. And thanks for everyone who's been supporting us there. We've got swag on our Geyser Fund now and all sorts of good stuff there. So be sure to check that out again in the show notes. All right, everyone, I'll let you get to the episode now. And we'll see you again next week. Hey, Ahmed, welcome to the Progressive Bitcoiner. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Trey. I'm excited to be here.
Absolutely. I'm excited to have you on as well. And for people watching on YouTube, you can clearly see that I'm not there in person. We had toyed with doing this in person at your studio down in Brooklyn. So I'm bummed to not do that. I promise people. What's that?
In Manhattan, actually, but
why did I think it was in Brooklyn? Either way, in New York City, in Manhattan, even better.
Yeah,
I'm so bummed.
Like that weird rivalry, right, between Brooklynites and Manhattanites.
yeah, I've got friends in Brooklyn that like won't go into Manhattan. Anyway, we could talk about that for 30 minutes, and people will be like, "What the hell is going on?" But we'll, you know, I get down there in person and have to do this in person. But either way, super excited to have you on. I think there's so much in your background. There's so much in your story for such a rich conversation across a variety of topics in this episode. I mean, we can talk about upbringing and being born and kind of thoughts around Lebanon and folks in the Bitcoin space. I think in particular, thinking about some of these elements of being in a place like Lebanon and currency devaluation and you know, different things like that in terms of Bitcoin. Talk about design and creativity, which is stuff I kind of like to talk about a lot on this podcast with recent guests. For those that have been listening to the pod know, I like to kind of get into that and what that looks like with Bitcoin adoption and really cool stuff outside of finance, as we were just talking. So really excited to just hear everything from you. But for folks that don't know you, you want to give folks a little bit of background, you know, what you do, maybe a little bit of your background. I'll probably go a little bit more into your background in this conversation, but just a little intro into who you are and what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Ahmed Klink. I was born in Lebanon in the early 1980s, you know, in the midst of a civil war that was going on. My parents were actually studying in Romania under a communist regime at the time. So I grew up in Lebanon with my grandparents while my parents were finishing their medical school, and eventually, you know, they figured out that it would be safer for me to get out of the country. So my 17-year-old cousin who was going to go and travel to France kind of took me with him, and I was 3 years old at the time, and we escaped Lebanon through Syria, and from Syria we went to France, where I met my parents. They moved there, and that's where I grew up. I grew up in France for most of my life, basically, essentially being a war refugee from the Lebanese civil war. I grew up in France. I experienced sort of the first currency change of my life when the franc moved to the euro, which was an interesting experiment. That was kind of my first introduction to like currency and like what's going on. I was like, oh, that's weird. Like they're taking 6 francs and making it a euro. And I was like, that sounds kind of odd. But okay, you know, and I was a teenager. I didn't really pay attention to stuff like that. And I grew up being super into computers. Had a great childhood. Super into art as well. I was taking my camera. My dad was a pretty good photographer and painter. France was full of culture. Grew up around Van Gogh's house. You know, visiting museums and really being attuned to, I think it developed my taste. Eventually decided to go into engineering and studied engineering in France in college, and eventually went to the US to study biomedical engineering to get my PhD in New York. And that was around the time that, you know, the financial crisis, 2007, 2008, at a time that Bitcoin was born and or discovered rather. And I think, you know, it was a very interesting time to move to the US. And New York does its thing, right? I was studying for my PhD, but eventually after I graduated, ended up being a photographer and a director. Mm-hmm. Founded my own company, a design studio, creative company called Sunday Afternoon, down in New York City. It's been quite a journey, for sure.
Yeah, that was one thing that surprised me in your bio when I was doing some research for the show was the engineering background. I was like, what? The guy's a PhD and I did not know this. Like, and Daniel from our team, for folks that don't know, made this connect. Daniel works now on PubKey as well, and many of you will know on our show and has been on our show, made this connect. And I just thought that I was like, I'm so one thing I was like so envious, because I find myself getting envious of folks that are able to think in that way, but mm-hmm. then also be so brilliantly creative. I was like, that's just not fair. That's just two different things that you have, which is very, very cool. Being in New York, I totally get what you mean. And probably feeling pulled in a different direction.
Yeah, I mean, I was really into photography when I moved to the city, and you know, I just kept shooting here. I think I was super into music. I was going to concerts and shooting a lot of shows downtown. Mm. Like cake shop pianos, all these little bars, and you know, shooting live performances. And I started shooting for places like Pitchfork, you know, that mm-hmm. were coming out on the scene, like kind of independent media and music publications. And you know, I started photographing like Leaky Lee and like kind of these bands that were coming out on the scene at the time. And one thing led to another. I started sneaking backstage. I started shooting bigger music festivals. I started shooting more portraiture, and eventually, you know, kind of built a little bit of a portfolio where I had, you know, The Roots, Questlove, John Legend, like people like this that I was able to take to magazines and be like, hey, can I shoot for you? And, you know, they liked the work, and you know, they gave me my first assignment, I believe, that was for the Source magazine, where I shot Kevin Hart back in 2011.
Oh, wow.
When he was just kind of a little bit of a, you know, comedian, stand-up yeah. comedian. It wasn't like this.
Yeah, probably just coming out of some of the clubs in New York, yeah.
Absolutely. And, yeah, spent some time shooting with Kevin Hart. Hopefully, you know, basically what happened is that my portfolio grew up basically with the celebrities that I was shooting. So having Kevin Hart in my book helped. And I went on to shoot a lot of NBA players, which was kind of a dream come true. I went to Oklahoma City to shoot Russell Westbrook. Time with him, so it was great. Steph Curry in Oakland. Anthony Davis. It's been wild to spend time with athletes like this, and yeah, it's a cool job.
Who do you pull for in terms of basketball? From what I understand, France, I feel like, has a decent basketball scene as well. Yeah. So you probably started your love for it there, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I was a huge basketball fan growing up. I mean, I would stay up to watch NBA. Jordan's, the Bulls, but I was a Knicks fan. I mean, always been a Knicks fan.
Yeah.
Too much of my, dismay. It's tough sometimes. But we're having a decent season, so I'm excited about that.
It's funny. I was at the Garden, and obviously when I say the Garden in Boston, there's the TD Garden, and then New York, you're like, oh, Madison Square Garden. So I was like, I think I posted on Noster, like, oh, at the Garden watching the Celtics like beat the Knicks or something, just to piss off some of our New York friends. And then I think Evan from Zeus commented, and he was like, you mean the TD Garden? Like, the Garden is Madison Square Garden. So just having that back and forth. I watched the Celtics beat the Knicks. So that was pretty fun.
Evan, longtime New Yorker, like he's going to set you straight, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
There's only one Garden.
Yeah. Maybe we'll go down the basketball rabbit hole, and then I'll just do a spinoff pod for that one. And then we'll do a separate conversation for Bitcoin. Yeah. Cool. I mean, I guess one thing that I'd want to hear and folks would want to hear as well, like genuinely want to hear, is where your, I guess, Bitcoin journey started. You alluded to a little bit in terms of, okay, seeing obviously coming out of Lebanon and probably reflecting on that, and then being in France and seeing that currency transition in a little bit different ways. So what for you started making you think more about these things and then go full into being, a Bitcoiner?
Yeah, it's been a slow realization for sure. The first time I encountered Bitcoin was really, I mean, I moved in New York right at the right time, right? Like November 2007, right? So the financial crisis is going on, and Occupy Wall Street was a big movement, and Bitcoin was something that was living alongside of Occupy Wall Street down in the park, and that's the first time I heard about it, around 2008, 2009. That's the first time I heard the word Bitcoin. And, I didn't pay much attention to it at the time. I think my headspace was more kind of like, let's punish the bankers and join Occupy Wall Street and do what we can to solve this problem by protesting, right? And so I dismissed it. I was like, I didn't really pay much attention to it. And I really focused on my PhD at the time, just studying biomedical engineering. My headspace was, it was that and photography, right? Like, I didn't have time for anything else. Fast forward to maybe 2014, 2015, where Bitcoin came back into my consciousness. I started paying attention a little bit more to it, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, the price of it is up. But it wasn't really until 2016 and 2017 that I was like, this thing is sticking, and I need to Google this. Like, I need to really do some research. I had graduated. I had, my career in photography, was moving along, and I think I had a little more brain space to kind of examine the situation. And, so I started really looking a bit more into it and reading about it. And yeah, I think it was, you know, of course you go down the rabbit hole of like shit coins and all of this. Mm-hmm. It wasn't an instant realization that that Bitcoin is, you know, the answer to, you know, fighting inflation, all this. So I fell down the rabbit hole of like all these shit coins and all of that. And it really wasn't until like Saif al-Din's Bitcoin Standard that truly opened my eyes to what was going on. And mm-hmm. Reading that book, you know, Saif al-Din being Palestinian and, you know, having grown, like lived in Lebanon and studied in Lebanon, that was such a revelation for me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that book really opened my eyes and you know, I think even before then, I think I've always been a really good self-learner, you know, like self-taught in photography, I'm self-taught in directing, I'm self-taught in Bitcoin just as much, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that helped me a lot. And then me reading about Bitcoin and learning about Bitcoin, putting that in parallel with what was happening on in Lebanon in 2019, 2020, I started talking to my mom and my grandparents in Lebanon, and really understanding how the currency crisis in Lebanon had happened. I mean, by the time I was born, the smallest bill that we had was 1,000 Lebanese lira. Mm. And I was like, Mom, what's your experience? Because I'm sure it wasn't like that for you. And she was like, well, not at all. By the time I left Lebanon to go study, you know, in Romania, the dollar would buy you 2 pounds. Mm-hmm. You know? So
yeah.
It was a stable currency that was pegged to gold all the way up to 1971. Mm-hmm. Actually, Lebanon has, I think, the 19th largest gold reserves in the world.
Oh, wow. Like still to this day?
Yeah, still to this day. Yeah. And the main reason why they have such large reserves is because they essentially refuse to liquidate their gold reserves when they need it to. Mm-hmm. When the gold peg was severed in 1973 by Richard Nixon, instead what they did is they depleted their foreign currencies reserves instead of mm-hmm. of selling their gold. Eventually they jacked up interest rates and offered bonds to Lebanese people that lived abroad so that, you know, they could send their money back to Lebanon, right? Euros, mm-hmm. dollars, because they depleted their reserves current, they depleted their foreign currency reserves so much that they needed more deposits, right? So
yeah,
they basically reached out to people like my parents and be like, hey, you guys live in France, like, do you want to deposit your euros for 20% yield? You know?
Yeah.
And I was like, you didn't fall for that, right?
Yeah, right.
And, you know, a lot of people did. A lot of people did. A lot of people send their money to Lebanon and were hoping to get the yield. It worked mm-hmm. until it didn't, you know?
Yeah.
The banks closed and people couldn't take out their euros, couldn't take out their dollars anymore. So basically full-blown Ponzi scheme.
Do you think in that regard it was the yield chasing? Do you think it was a bit of, we need to support our currency, kind of like a patriotic notion? What do you think was kind of the main motivation for folks to do that? I expect maybe the latter, but I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both, right? Lebanese people have a lot of family that still live in Lebanon, right? Mm-hmm. And not dissimilar to other countries in you know, like El Salvador, they send remittances all the time, right? Yeah. So they send money back to the country, to their families, to my grandparents. So that's not something that's necessarily foreign to them. And of course, they want to support the currency because their family is there. What are you going to do? You know, like it's, I think it's a combination of both. And, but at the same time, you know, I'm talking to my dad and like, Dad, you know, when the yield is too good to be true, it probably is, you know? And if you don't know where it's coming from, you know, you know the saying, you're the yield. You know, and but like even my grandfather, like it's nuts. Like it's crazy what yield will do to people. Like my grandfather sold land that he owned. To put money in the bank to earn 20% yield on it. Like it will just mess up with people's head. It will make it spin completely. You know, I feel fortunate in some capacity that, you know, I'm kind of primed to that because the yields in the US are going to go up. And when that happens, people are going to deposit money in the bank to earn that yield. But the story doesn't really end well. Because the debt burden grows so big that eventually the principal never gets paid back. And that's essentially the story of Lebanon, you know. 2 years ago, my grandmother, who's about 100 years old, you know, we were just kind of going around her house and you know, obviously she has a lot of cash in the home that's kind of stashed around in several, you know, places. And you kind of tallied up, like, everything she had and you know, you kind of tallied up to 30 million Lebanese pounds, 30 million Lebanese pound. And that just pays for 6 months of electricity. When my mom like tallied all the money and, you know, figured out like how long this was going to last her, you know, she, my grandmother looked at my mom and she said, she pulled out like, I think a one Lebanese lira bill. And she told my mom, this was when the money was worth something in this country, and they destroyed it all. You know, it happened over the lifetime of my grandmother, you know, over 80, 100 years. And I think that's something that, yeah, something people don't really realize how slow it, slowly it happens, you know?
This episode of the Progressive Bitcoiner is brought to you by Zeus. Zeus is a self-custodial Bitcoin wallet for Android and iOS. The app features a built-in Lightning node that allows you to take full control of how you make payments on-chain and on Lightning. You can easily onboard to the Lightning network and let Zeus's Lightning service provider, Olympus, do all the heavy lifting for you. Or you can get more hands-on and curate your own Lightning channels with whoever you transact with most. Zeus has best-in-class privacy and allows you to have great peace of mind when sending and receiving Lightning payments. Not only does the Zeus team not want to know how you're using your money, but they're building things in a way that they can't know. There's also a first-of-its-kind Lightning address that will allow you to receive payments 24/7 to your mobile wallet self-custodially. This is a great solution for a range of people, for those who just want to have the technical ability to set up their own infrastructure, to nomads and dissidents that need to accept donations on the move. Other Lightning wallets don't give the users this level of control. In fact, many of them operate more like bank accounts that can be revoked and ultimately lead to you losing your money. With Zeus, you're in full control of your private keys and therefore can start to take full control of your financial destiny. Save 5% on LSP fees using code TPB in the access code under LSP settings. To learn more and to learn where to download, head to ZeusLN.com.
But one thing, if you could help the listeners understand a little bit, maybe not the specific dates, you know, unless you have them, but just in general, you know, you're talking about this, this can happen over a lifetime, and then some things can happen overnight, you know, banks closing and people trying to get their banks out. But when things got much worse, kind of talk to people about when that time period was and what that looks like for an average family. You mentioned bank closing, because a lot of people, you know, hear these things loosely, but I just want to kind of paint a picture for folks as well in terms of what that looks like when that, you know, okay, they have this yield product, okay, and then all of a sudden folks are starting to realize and starting to wake up to, oh, this isn't what I thought it was.
Right.
And then things happen quickly after that, whether it's revolution, whether it's violence, whether it's banks closing, whether it's something more peaceful. There's a variety of ways it looks. So just if you could paint a picture for the listeners, I think they'd appreciate that.
Yeah, I think the timeline of this, it gets confusing even for, you know, people like my family they tend to think of inflation as something that is episodic. You know, when I talk to them about inflation, and I, you know, mentioned the 1970s, they're like, oh, so it happened before. It's not the first time. And I'm like, no, what you don't understand is that it's always happening. It's not that it has happened before. It's not that it's going to happen again. It is always and ever present at every single moment.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's like the fish in the water, right? Except the water here is inflation.
Right.
But in Lebanon's case, it really happened over, I would say things really accelerated in the 1980s with the war. Mm-hmm. and the war reparations that needed to happen. And, you know, like I mentioned, they refused to sell the gold to do that, right? So there is only one way to finance all these wars reparation is really to, you know, devalue the currency and essentially pay with it with, you know, foreign depositors' money and foreign reserves. So, you know, I was born in 1983. Let's put it in terms of the price of a pack of gum, right? In 1983, the dollar could buy you about four Lebanese pounds, right? And a Lebanese pound could buy you a pack of gum. 10 years, I would say, you know, by the time I was 10, my own pack of gum, I was spending 250 Lebanese pound on it, right? So that was kind of, you would think that's the acceleration phase. But today you need to spend 25,000 Lebanese pound.
Wow, yeah.
To buy a pack of gum.
Yeah.
So it's like there's no bottom. It's absolutely crazy. The amount of devaluation that can happen. But really it started, I think it's what's episodic is the acceleration phase, right? Like, you know, if you're able to keep inflation down to 2-4%, it's like people don't really pay attention to it. But once you have these flare ups, that's where, you know, people kind of notice it and freak out about it a little bit. But yeah, another example, you know, of an acceleration moment is when my mom was 18 years old. You know, my grandfather sadly passed away during the war, and she inherited some land that she sold to pay for what she thought was going to be 6 years of medical school. And the currency devalued so fast over that year that she only was able to pay for one.
Wow.
You know, so when it goes from 4 Lebanese pound to 250, I mean, that's it. You're wiped out. You're wiped out that quickly. So yeah, the timeline is it's always happening. It's always present. And you know, the slower it is, the more insidious it is, I think, for people to notice. It really is tough. It really is very complicated. And I think today the exchange rate is like what? Let's see. I think it's something ridiculous. It's a dollar buys you 19,000 Lebanese pound.
And what, 20 years ago? Well, 20, 30 years ago,
yeah,
we're looking at a dollar buys four, right? Well, four, absolutely. Five, six, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about an inflation rate of 865,000% or something mm-hmm. ridiculous like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Over 40 years.
Yeah. And I think back to your point for, you know, a lot of our listeners are, you know, US, Europe based. When you said, you know, when it's slower, when it's lower, also what we see is just isn't just in the US. I'm sure in Lebanon, folks had different theories or different dogmatic approaches. Well, it happened because of this. No, it happened because of this. And so in the US, we see this, right? Whether it's, you have some folks, including the Bitcoin community, I'll say, because I've been talking to a lot of economists, human rights folks. I'm a lot in the normie world with my career and things like that. So one argument is like it's money printing and only money printing ever is causing this effect. Or no, it's a lot of times from Democrats and folks on the left because Joe Biden is in power, not because it's a party stance, will say, well, it's a supply crisis. And actually, Joe Biden spending on this package has only helped it, period, right? And no nuance, no gray, and no going back to your original point of what we talk about as, you know, WTF happened in 1971, like depegging from gold, getting into this cycle, this debt cycle, looking in the US at $35 trillion in debt, also being a global leader in lending. Like, what does that mean going forward? And for lack of better words, like a lot of folks just kind of saying and acting, well, that we'll deal with that at some point. You know, that'll be fine. It'll be fine because it's always been fine. So it's people develop theories when it's only 2-3%. When theories start to unravel, I think is sometimes like you're saying, when this moment of crisis happens, and then people are like, I don't care who or what caused it. Like it's happening. This is awful. This is horrible. Like that's stuff that, you know, all of this kind of fighting on Twitter and this and that, it goes out the window in moments like that. And again, I'm not really a doomsdayer with the US situation. I think they find really, really creative ways to kick the can down the road for a long time and continue. They're very good at that. Very good at sneaky mechanisms to keep this going, to tell people, you know, inflation, like what people don't know is inflation kind of went up 20% since COVID. Doesn't mean it's going back down. It just means it's slowly increasing.
I mean, yeah, there, to your point, 20 to 22. Yeah. 25% since 2020. I mean,
yeah,
that's a pretty big number, you know.
Pretty big for the largest economy in the world. It's pretty, absolutely. It's pretty crazy.
It is. And to your point about, you know, what causes it is really interesting. I mean, Lebanon needed to support the economy, right? Needed to rebuild the country, needed, like, GDP went down, but actually government finance GDP went up. And I think they found it's kind of the chicken and the egg situation. It's like once they refuse to sell the gold, like you don't have any other chance. Like you don't have you don't have any other options, right?
Yeah.
It's done.
Yeah. That makes sense. And I think, you know, from this conversation, it's kind of like when saying, you know, what causes inflation, right? I'm not gonna lie, it is a very complicated situation, right? But I think there are some major factors that we're talking about. And the reason that we're probably both into Bitcoin is that too often governments and centralized power and folks that might not have the best interest in mind or in the US would rather perpetuate forever wars and kick cans down the road and be manipulative with different practices, regardless of anyone's political identity. You know, those things we'd like to separate money from. We'd like to have a more democratic say and process in things, which is the beauty of Bitcoin being this open source money for everyone that we talk about on this podcast a lot. And that's the beauty of it. And now tying it into Lebanon, some of it is theoretical, some of it is practical. I'd love for you to talk on what you know of, you know, thinking of Bitcoin in light of something like that. Mm-hmm. And then thinking of what are some use cases or ways folks have found to use Bitcoin in Lebanon? Because I think there's a lot of different thinking around this. I think we're clearly not in a position where, you know, we can say, oh, everyone in Lebanon is using Bitcoin and they're on a Bitcoin standard and this is just great, right? And I'm not saying a lot of people do that. And then on the other side, the flip is a lot of folks, I think, that are just against Bitcoin will say Bitcoin will never be used in the global south or in a place like Lebanon. People can't afford it, or it's not an actual use case, or whatever. So how do you think about those things? Like theoretically, what Bitcoin can do in this context, but also practically of how people are using it today?
I mean, I haven't had to, you know, my mom got Bitcoin immediately. Like I didn't have to explain it to her for a long time. You know, she, because of what happened to her, because she's been she's seen her savings being wiped. She understood the value of it and having a store value. I think her generation, her brothers and sisters, it's really tough because the Lebanese community loves cash. It's unbelievable. I think at least the boomer generation, if they can't touch it, for them it's not real.
Sure.
And I think that obviously for the most of the population in Lebanon, that caused some, you know, that probably slowed down the numbers of people that got into Bitcoin, because it's such a, you know, even when my mom tries to explain it to them, they're like, but it's not real. You can't touch it. You can't. And it's kind of a stupid thing, but it is something that they're really, you know, I don't know. It's because for them, gold and cash was money, you know, for that generation was like, the cash was backed by gold, and that's how it worked, right? But my cousins, it's a different conversation. They're, you know, people that are in their 30s, in their 20s, they get it immediately. And, you know, they run their own nodes. And of course, there's some, you know, you got to separate the signal from the noise, because there's a lot of shitcoining happening in Lebanon too, right? In a state of crisis, you know, some people are going to take advantage of, they're going to take advantage of that to try to sell you some kind of snake oil, right?
I mean, we've talked about on this show before that, you know, someone like Binance is hugely popular in marketing around those areas, around Africa, different places, trying to monopolize on all of, you know, whether someone might see kind of in the US, but on an amplified scale of, oh, that coin is cheaper than Bitcoin. Oh, I'm going to jump into this because I'm going to make a lot more money on that one, because it'll go up 500% overnight compared to Bitcoin. Like all of that same stuff we hear and think about in the US, but amplified maybe because of more desperation, maybe so because of more like, I want this money.
Yeah. So
I get it.
That is so true. I mean, you know, there's so many, even, you know, closest friends in my family, like they fell for whatever coin that was cheaper than Bitcoin, because Bitcoin seems unattainable to them. I think I think you need 8 billion Lebanese pounds to buy Bitcoin today. So it's, you know, for someone who's in their 20s, it's absolutely completely crazy. But you also have to educate them about unit bias and things like this, right? So but yes, like Binance definitely made a killing in Lebanon, and they marketed a lot of shitcoin to people. So, you know, there are groups like Bitcoin Lebanon that is, you know, that has wonderful people in it, like people like Suli, that do a great job of educating people in Lebanon about that. And, you know, I do my best as well to talk to people there and explain to them why this shitcoin is not Bitcoin, essentially.
Yeah.
And, you know, books like The Bitcoin Standard that are being translated, Saif Dean doing podcasts in Arabic, like all of that stuff is coming to Lebanon, and I think is going to educate people and the next generation. So I'm super hopeful. I mean, even Peter McCormick, right, went down there and did a film recently. So I think I'm pretty hopeful that that they'll get it. For now, I think it's still, you know, USDT is a big one. Tether, USD stable coins are hugely, because Lebanese people from the boomer generation always considered the dollar as a saving vehicle, which is totally fair, you know. Like I think to me, when my grandfather, you know, gave me dollars, it meant more than when he gives me a Lebanese pound, right? Like
it's It's relative, right?
Absolutely.
Like it's completely relative. That makes sense. You know, we in the US talk about inflation, but like compared to that, yeah, it makes sense why that's a more of a quote unquote gold standard.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the Egyptian pound, Lebanese pound, all of these currencies, mm-hmm. yes. Like the first gateway is going to be the US dollar. And it's been for years. It's been since probably the 1970s, you know? And this is part of why the Lebanese central bank depleted all the dollar reserves that they had to support their own currencies, right? And then they mm-hmm. were like, hey, send us more from abroad. All of you Lebanese people that live in the US, all of you Lebanese yeah. people that live in Europe, send us your, you know, your foreign currencies and earn some yield, right? So they deplete it all. And then eventually you can't take it out anymore. And I think once that happens, maybe you discover that you need a store of value that you can control, right? Something mm-hmm. like Bitcoin, where you control the keys, you control who you send it to, and you keep your purchasing power. I mean, like it's I don't know what people would do without Bitcoin. Seriously, it's mind blowing when you think about it. Like there wouldn't be any escape, right? There mm-hmm. wouldn't be any way to protect yourself from the devaluation of your currency. I mean, you know, my grandfather did everything right. He had land, but then somehow got convinced that his land was worthless.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I think once folks, I mean, I think of it in my own life in the US, I can't imagine in that context, once you think of Bitcoin as this global monetary network, like censorship resistant, permissionless, open source code that thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands, eventually millions of folks are really dedicated to running nodes, like keeping this network and consensus model alive. Censorship resistant property. So even if someone thinks their property is useless, like having this 12 word backup or having, you know, borderless payments, if you needed to get out in a hurry, like you don't have to go and try to get your gold out of a vault or try to get, you know, access your or sell your property really quick to flee. You know, I think in terms of it really pisses me off when there's so much FUD about Bitcoin in places like Lebanon or other places, right? Right. I guarantee you, we shouldn't be saying stories of saying, okay, Bitcoin is used everywhere in Lebanon. Everything's great because people are all using Bitcoin, this and that. Like, no, but Bitcoin is 15 years old. Like, come on, this is so, so new in a revolution where the monetary supply isn't going to even complete the 21 million cap until 2100. Like, we're so freaking early. And I promise you, people are catching on and people will. I think it definitely is a privilege point to be like, oh, I think the reactions, it almost feels like people are saying, oh, they're too stupid, or they wouldn't understand, or this context, they wouldn't understand what Bitcoin is or what Bitcoin should be used for. And I'm like, I guarantee they understand it better than I do. Like if you were faced with the reality of figuring out how am I going to be able to afford life and how am I going to be able to have something, Bitcoin will be there for people. And that's what I'm extremely bullish, as we say on.
Yeah, I mean, you got to remember that, you know, like you said, Bitcoin is only 15 years old, and the big currency devaluation that happened in Lebanon happened 2 or 3 years ago. Like that, like up until then, the up until 2016, 2017, 2018, around then, even. Hold on a second.
Yeah, no worries.
Even up until then, the Lebanese pound was pegged to the dollar, right? Like it was 1500. That's it. That was the fixed rate. And so over the lifetime of Bitcoin, the big currency devaluation in Lebanon only happened like very recently. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to, you know, it's going to take time. And I think over the next decade, a lot of people are going to understand what's going on. Because I think they're going to realize that there's essentially not a lot of differences between the Lebanese pound, the euro, the yen, the USD, it's mm-hmm. it's all fiat currency.
Yeah.
And once you understand that, you got to figure out, you know, what are you going to invest in that's going to help you, you know, essentially keep the fruit of your labor. And the answer is Bitcoin, of course.
Hi, everyone. Hope you're enjoying the episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Bitbox. Now, Bitbox is a hardware wallet that's open source, incredibly secure and easy to use, and it's what I'm using to safely secure my Bitcoin in cold storage. Now, I know self-custodying Bitcoin can really be intimidating, but Bitbox is designed for ease of use without compromising on security. It's USB-C compatible and allows you to easily back up and restore your private keys with a micro SD card, which is really cool. Now, you can purchase the Bitbox using the promo code TPB at the link found in the show notes for 5% off your purchase. And I really want to thank Bitbox for their support of the podcast, and I'm really excited about this new partnership. All right, I'll let you get back to the episode now. It's a proper evolution for humanity, not to get too philosophical, but it almost makes sense, right? I think for some, especially some of the louder voices in Bitcoin in the US, or some folks that are abrasive to Bitcoin, might be, okay, they hear a lot of the US like libertarians talking about it, and to like hearkening back to a day, right? Hearkening back to like, oh, we're going to live on our own citadels and hoard wealth and all of this stuff, right? But I think the way I view it, not coming from that camp, but kind of understanding, I view it as a natural evolution of humanity not having to rely on authoritarian regimes or governments that are hostile to their people, or all of these incentives that they are so human centric that there's going to be points of fault or a political process. Like in the US, especially all over, but in the US, I think, you know, political candidates coming in and out, they're trying to stay in office. They're not necessarily thinking about, you know, my grandkids or something like that. They say they will, right? But they're coming in and off in and out of office every 4 years. Now, I'm not sitting here saying we should have leaders that are in office even longer, but what I'm saying is they're doing campaign pitches. They're not going to do things that are not popular for their reelection, which in the US, for instance, it could be raising taxes and lowering spending to approach the deficit. No one's going to do that, because then another candidate will win who will say, I'm not going to do that. And they'll keep kicking the can until it's too late. And back to your point about fiat currencies, they're all kind of on the same path, just different time horizons, right? Some are more immediate. Like we see like inflation with what happened after COVID, some places hyperinflated more, but everyone inflated. You know what I mean? Like everyone had some level of inflation because of so many factors, right? But my point being the interconnectedness of these systems, and then also seeing that they're all feeling the same weight, again, just different extremes and different time horizons. That should be, I think that was a wake-up call for some people that's like, I'm learning about Bitcoin, and I trust that a bit more than I do this flaky government system that seems not really sure what's going to happen.
I mean, yeah, funny thing, you know, talking about that in politics a little bit, one of the things that actually threw Lebanon and into more of a social unrest was when the government wanted to tax WhatsApp calls.
Really? I don't think I heard about this. Wow.
They wanted to tax WhatsApp calls.
Wow.
Because there's so many people, you know, so many Lebanese that live abroad and obviously keep in touch with their families in Lebanon. And I think it was around, you know, 2019 when the government was like, well, why don't we just tax these calls and make money off of it? And people went crazy. They just descended on the streets and protested. Like, I mean, how silly does that sound?
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of like, it's different, but tapping into like, you know, a TikTok ban, like in the US, or imagine if they were like, we're going to tax TikTok, and that would send young people on the streets. It's actually really funny. But yeah, that's another thing of like a centralized platform like WhatsApp that might coordinate with the government.
Yeah.
in a place like Lebanon, it's very widely used there. That's, wow, that's insane. Desperation. I get it.
Absolutely. Completely desperate to increase revenues, right? Obviously the law didn't pass because people protested against it so much that,
yeah.
But it's funny to think about that. You would never think about, you know, what if you taxed social media? Like, holy shit. I mean, Trey, that might be coming. I don't know.
I mean, there's a variety of things that we just don't know and are coming. And I think the biggest thing is the longer that Bitcoin sticks around, the more that, yes, you know, it keeps going up in price and gets people interested. And for everyone listening, if we haven't said it enough, like, you know, don't try to trade this. This is not what Bitcoin, everything we're talking about is just having like a, like saving store of value, like spending it in places where it's really needed, like censorship resistant payments, things like that. We talk about a lot. This is to remedy a lot of the situations we talked back about, you know, 2008, Occupy. Like, this is to remedy the, for lack of better terms, fuckery that banks, governments, corporations get into with money, with individual wealth, property, all of these things that Bitcoin was designed to try to remedy. And I think it does a pretty good job of that. It's just increasing adoption. It's kind of the bigger thing for me.
Yeah, it is. And then there's a lot of work to do about that. You know, like when I look at Lebanon and the photos that I've seen of it, the stories that I've heard from my grandmother, you know, my parents in the 50s and the 60s, it was an absolutely beautiful country where, you know, they had American cars. The movie theaters were packed. The shows. I mean, Beirut was the Paris of the Middle East. And Lebanon was essentially mostly a free market economy with a currency pegged to, you know, the dollar and by virtue to gold. And going back to a sound money standard is absolutely needed. And this is just kind of how, in my mind, history works. I think it's ebbs and flows. It's cycles. Mm-hmm. And the cycle of fiat currencies is destined to end at some point. I'm excited. I'm excited to see where the world goes in the next 10, in the next 20 years. It's going to be really, really interesting. And you know, I kind of feel fortunate that we get to live this.
I know, isn't it cool?
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's why I think Lynn Alden said it well in her book. I think in her book, Broken Money, which I advise people to read. I think Broken Money is getting translated quite a bit these days as well. I'm not sure how many languages it's in already, but I think it's making the rounds with a lot of translations. But I think she said it on podcasts as well. But you know, analyzing money, analyzing commodities, analyzing global macro conditions. One of the things that she kind of said, and apologies, Lynn, I'm paraphrasing here, was kind of like, I'm not sure, you know, if there wasn't for Bitcoin, I'm not sure what other option there is. Like looking at, you know, where this road is headed, where these trains are headed, not knowing exactly when, again, like I said, like a place like the US, like some of the other local currencies are going to fail first, as we're seeing, obviously, the USD will probably be one of the last, if not the last. If it weren't for Bitcoin, I'm not sure what answer we would have. So I feel very fortunate to have discovered it and just heard really amazing people tell really amazing stories about it, for how it's benefited my own, again, very privileged Western life, not to mention the radical transformations it can make for someone fleeing authoritarian regimes and being able to carry your wealth with you and have an answer like in those moments. Wild. Wow. For an open source, like simple code. Isn't that crazy?
It's absolutely beautiful. My dad actually, when he lived in communist Romania, he, you know, Levi's was complete. I just saw that you were wearing a Levi's shirt. It's kind of funny, but Levi's was completely banned out there. And he would cross the border to Italy to buy some Levi's jeans.
That's too funny.
Where, you know, maybe five or six of them on him, mm-hmm. and smuggle it back to Romania to sell it on campus.
Wow. That's awesome. So this has always been there in you. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You inherited it.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you probably wouldn't have to do that with Bitcoin.
Right.
No smuggling of Levi's.
Yeah. Well, what's very cool is directly related to this too, what we're seeing, and we'll continue to do shows on this. We've done shows recently, like Ludmila from the Open Dialogue Foundation talking about regulation throughout the world and EU and what sometimes government regulation can signify to other authoritarian regimes. It's like, oh, if democracies are cracking down on Bitcoin in this way, then we will, right? But what's been interesting about, sometimes we've been seeing some scary headlines about what could come in terms of regulation for Bitcoin. And I'm not saying there isn't any threat. There is. But regulators are having a tough time figuring out how to regulate Bitcoin when it's self-custodial, run by your own node, when it's set up correctly. And it's getting easier and easier than ever to do that, right? To actually, because what they're going to go after is the low-hanging fruit, which are the Binances, the Coinbases, the centralized exchanges that have to adhere to government rules and commerce and things like that. But even in the EU, recent law that they're proposing, this doesn't impact peer-to-peer payments or self-hosted wallets because they can't find an argument for that's kind of on the individual, right? And given the individual freedom to invest in what they want, right? Now, obviously, if that person is breaking the law with that and they discover that, sure, like you know, financing terrorism and legitimate charges, sure. But peer-to-peer payments, self-hosted wallets, I've gotten a lot more hopeful on that front recently. And that does great things for what we're talking about in situations like Lebanon, right? And just all of these apps and technologies and even ruling, they're saying that hardware wallet providers and other folks like, you know, creating these Lightning apps and whatever the case may be, they are not financial centers or like centralized exchanges, ruling that as well in the EU recently. It's been, I think some people have only been focusing on the negative of, oh, they're focusing more on exchanges. And I'm like, yeah, but they're realizing self-hosted is kind of hard to go after. And they don't really have good answers for it right now. Maybe they'll, hey, maybe other crackdowns will come. We have to be aware of that, but it's really hard to go after. And that's, I'm excited about that.
Yeah. I mean, let's play this out a little bit. Like if you ban self-hosted wallet, what do you do? Do you ban BlackRock's like self-custody wallet? Like you can't. Like they're, you know, Arc is self-custody. Like, well, actually they might be with Coinbase, but I think VanEck, I mean, there are some ETFs that are self-hosted wallets. Like,
yeah. I mean, Fidelity technically is self, but they're still an institution, right? So they could argue it's an institution, but I mean, yeah, the cat's out of the bag in a lot of ways is what I'm trying to say. And
yeah, for sure.
Again, just my own opinions and theories here. Like, again, you know, people like don't trust Verify, and you know, we could look back and say, oh wow, they found new ways to crack down. But Bitcoin was built for this. Bitcoin was built for this.
Yeah, kind of opposition. And I think if a crackdown like this comes along, I mean, we have to ask ourselves the difficult question of like, do we live in a free democracy, right? Like,
sure. Yeah. And if it does, then we don't, because Bitcoin is freedom of speech. Bitcoin is code. Bitcoin is remembering 12 words. Yeah. If my point to people that I've been trying to say is forget Bitcoin, if they're coming after Bitcoin in that way, that means that they're also coming after First Amendment rights here in the US and abroad. So it's not even about Bitcoin. It's not about me saying, let's overthrow the state. It's not even that regard. It's in the regard of like, oh, we're in a very post 9/11 there, invasive in every area of our life, which I don't think is good regardless of anyone's ideology. That's just not good for a free society. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm on about with this. That's where I hope we don't get to.
Yeah, I really hope we don't get there either. I think... because these questions get really, really difficult to raise, you know, as a society. We need, if they do come after Bitcoin like that, I think you're right. Like the First Amendment is in play. Like there's a lot of freedom infringements that are happening. And but I'm hopeful. I don't think America is, in my opinion, way more likely to embrace Bitcoin than it is to ban it in some way. I don't think it embeds so much of American values that I don't see that happening. You know, countries like China, yes, communist countries, yep. You know, for sure. But
and they can, because they control literally the internet and the airwaves and like satellite orbits. so that is much more, but there's still ways to do it. There's still ways. There are a lot of Chinese citizens using Bitcoin and mining Bitcoin. They're still having trouble with that.
Yeah, no, it's pretty incredible. I mean, to your point, it was built for this. So it's really the most American kind of discovery that Bitcoin is America, right? And America is Bitcoin. If you think about it, it's for a country that was built on freedom principles and free markets. It's going to embrace it. I mean, I don't think they would have approved ETFs if they were not looking to do that. So, and to your point, it's only 15 years into the process, so it's still early, and Bitcoin's for everyone, right? Like it is going to be for central banks. It is for hedge funds. It is for ETFs. It is for me. It is for you. It is for anyone who needs it. And mm-hmm. that's the beauty of it.
Yeah. And I think too, in terms of the US and Bitcoin, the way I think of Bitcoin too, and some people will say, oh, it's money. So they're more scared of it or threatened by it. I do view it as similar to the internet and a lot of things. Like I was born in the early 90s, right around the, and so obviously kind of like growing up, I remember like getting dial-up internet and seeing what the internet became, right? I do remember days before smartphones, of course, and being disconnected to the internet. But obviously there was a lot of hostility to the World Wide Web and different internet protocols when it first came about. But then it just became so hard to put back in the box that slowly you just saw the divisive language against the internet and people accessing the internet. They were very hostile towards it at first and saying, we need to control this. This is dangerous. It's for criminals. All the same stuff you hear about Bitcoin. And then slowly over time, that just faded out. And now the internet is everywhere. I truly do believe, and it's just a metaphor, and metaphors aren't perfect. I truly do believe Bitcoin is having the same journey where a lot of hostility initially will continue to be hostility here and there, just as the internet, right? With like freedom of speech on the internet, what does that look like? There's always going to be conversations and folks trying to approach it in different ways. But in terms of Bitcoin existing and people accessing Bitcoin and holding Bitcoin and using it, I do think it has a similar path, even bigger than the internet in terms of, listen, the cat's out of the bag and people are using it. It's here. That's how I view it.
I mean, it's going to be there, right? Whether with you or without you, right? Like Bitcoin is here. Bitcoin is here. And whether you get on board or not, like it's not going to care. And it's kind of, you know, it's just here. It's just for people that want to pay attention. It's here. And I think Michael Saylor said this. He was like, you probably have a decade to buy Bitcoin while people think that it's still dangerous and risky. And but because once that's done, I think the price of Bitcoin will be probably unattainable. Like that's where we are going, you know? I mean, and again, it's crazy. I think I'd like to look at it the other way around. I like to look at it that every day, you know, fiat currency buys you a little bit less Bitcoin, right? Like that is the ruthless part of it, is that, you know, every 4 years you're going to get less and less little Satoshis for whatever fiat currency is around. So it's, you know, it's kind of ruthless in that sense. And, you know, I try to educate my friends my family the fastest possible. But everybody's on their kind of own journey. But I'm curious, I mean, you being in the nonprofit space, do you talk about this? How do you see it play out?
Yeah, gosh, that's a whole other conversation too. You know, I think in my previous nonprofit, I had actually tried to do it. I've been, you know, currently I'm a grants director, so focus a lot on fundraising and grant writing and development work, things like that. And previous to this, and most of my nonprofit career, and kind of when I went on Peter McCormack's show a year or two ago, I think it was a year ago at this point, talking about like Bitcoin is hope for the younger generation. I was working with a lot of like youth development on like workforce development, working with like disadvantaged youth, working with urban community youth. And I saw a natural alignment there. And people started to know I was into Bitcoin and this and that. And I got some cautious like they're like, okay, yeah, but just, I don't know much about it, but just, you know, let them know it's your personal thing and not, you know, our works thing, you know, things like that. So got the message. It wasn't anything too hostile, but it was kind of like a, oh, that crypto thing. Okay. Yeah. Kind of cool. It wasn't, oh my gosh, no. And it wasn't, oh my gosh, yes. It was just kind of an indifference. And the amount of times I've wanted to institute that, it's just hard in a lot of nonprofits, especially nonprofits in Boston area. We're talking with a lot of progressive people. We're talking with a lot of Elizabeth Warren fans. We're talking with a lot of, like, I'm in a very, in New York City as well, you know, in very blue areas. And again, it's not that simple. I think it's more of a generational divide as well than even political sometimes, even though the red and blue arguments are a lot in the US. So yeah, if anything, it's just hard to have it meshed together. I mean, I see so many opportunities in nonprofits. Like, I would love any nonprofits to be mining Bitcoin and using that as a revenue stream. Shout out to Harrison Martinez. Him and I have talked about that before as well. Great, great opportunities there, teaching financial literacy and including Bitcoin into that. You know, not saying, hey, dump your life savings and buy Bitcoin, but just including that empowerment language. And I know, you know, Jack Dorsey and others did that down in Brooklyn, right? With forgetting the name of the institute, but there's been different programs. Obviously, Me Premier Bitcoin in El Salvador, you know, huge examples of teaching young people about these type of things. But, you know, the US, we're like the last place to need it in a lot of ways too, right? Even though a lot of communities in the US could really use it and do need it, I argue. But in terms of the institution of the US,
yeah,
we have payment rails, we have a stable currency,
yeah,
we have all of these things. So long story short, when I have mentioned it, they're like, that's cool. Yeah, I could see the human rights stuff you're talking about for that place over there. Okay. Because I started a lot with the human rights arguments, talking to friends and colleagues and things like that. So they're like, oh yeah, cool. That's Trey's thing. It's kind of left it to that. Right. And that's when I honestly put more time into writing and pursuing this podcast and stuff, was because I'm like, well, you know, I'll still try to advocate for that in the nonprofit space where I'm a leader in, but for the time being, I'll focus on education efforts for those that want to hear it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's kind of like, I'm just going to build my own thing and see where that goes.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I think that's.
Yeah. Cause I'm like, I don't want to sit and not do anything for that. You know, right. And in my nonprofit career, I'm very passionate about it. You know, I still get to like help people through those rails and a lot of things like that, even if it's outside of the Bitcoin bubble. But always in the back of my head, when I'm hearing about different programs that we're funding or different government programs, especially, you know, applying for grants and all this stuff, I'm like, this won't always be around. These folks are going to need something different. You know, I think about that a lot in the back of my mind.
I think, you're probably 10 steps ahead and, you know, we need you to be, right? Like, I think the world needs Bitcoiner to be ahead because there's going to be so much onboarding and explaining to do. We need to be sort of ahead and kind of lead that movement that's going to be coming. So I think it's super important. But a lot of it, you know, to your point about the US being the world reserve currency, is that we don't have any comparison point, right? Like, what do we compare the dollar to? Like the dollar is the standard. Everything is being compared to the dollar. And I think it trips a lot of people up. It's like, oh, well, the dollar is the standard. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you look at the inflation rate of the dollar against Bitcoin, it's pretty damn, it's not flattering. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think everything we're talking about can resonate with people if they're open to it. And I think I've said this many times before. I think people can be open and receptive to Bitcoin or even the problems that we're talking about. They have to first identify that there's a problem with our current system. And I think it's becoming more and more apparent. Our politics is fractured. Our money is fractured. Government operations are fractured. And I'm not saying Bitcoin solves all those things. Some things with politics and leaders and egomaniacs, there can be an egomaniac that owns a lot of Bitcoin. Like, is some things are not solved by it. But I think there are quite a few Bitcoiners that are interested in rallying together and solving more things than money is one thing, and money is kind of an underpinning to everything. But a lot of Bitcoiners are weary of centralized authority, regardless of who is in the White House, regardless of who is in charge. So kind of that question, that healthful questioning of authority, those kind of things. ripe for Bitcoin.
That's something that I think about a lot. If you were to play out, you know, Bitcoin and the state, who controls the keys? Is it a multi-seat quorum? What happens if you have an authoritarian, you know, president? Does he control the keys? Can he leave with the keys? You know,
I mean, did you hear? Who was on Peter McCormack's podcast recently? Nick Bhatia, I think, was talking about El Salvador and like who has the keys. Like they talked about, they have their wallet in cold storage.
It's been in the back of my mind.
Yeah, so they were talking about, okay, you know, who had, they said they have this wallet. You know, they posted the address, but says it's in cold storage within our nation's territory. Who has access to the keys? Can Bukele run off with the keys? Yeah. Can some other government official run off? I've had these crazy theories starting to think like, what if we take, all right, government, even if it's money printing, whatever, government, you know, spends 5% of the revenue on Bitcoin mining, and then the dividends are the rewards paid out to citizens, like crazy stuff. And I'm not saying that's even good or great in terms of that's still tied to some central policy, that's still, you know, government taking money in the first place to do these. You know, there's a lot of things that could be not as easy as, yeah, that's great right away. But I'm like, if the state is going to do something with it, there is quite a bit of good, or having, you know, different initiatives. I think Gridless is almost kind of an example of this throughout Africa, right? What they're trying to do in terms of rolling out renewable energy and having the community be a part of the process and benefiting from Bitcoin. I think there's so many social benefits, regardless of whether it's government funded, private, citizen collective, Fediment, of like reaping the benefits of what Bitcoin does. That's what I think is super cool. And I think El Salvador is trying to do that a little bit, but I'm definitely, it's nothing personal about Nayib Bukele. I know this is a very, people feel very strong emotions one way or another about this figure. It's more like any government official, any government doing these type of things. It's interesting to see how it'll play out for sure.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think these questions are going to come to, what I love about, you know, most Bitcoiners is that they will always question, right? Like who, like I'm glad Nick brought that up. I think these are an important question to ask, you know, if states are going to start to, you know, have their own wallets, and, you know, there needs to be a level of transparency on like who hold the keys, like who that is hugely, that's such a hugely important question. It's exciting to think about these things, to even, the fact that we get to ask these questions is kind of crazy, but you know, I think we'll have to put these programs in place, right? Like, yeah, something we have to think about, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
The head of treasury holds a key. The president holds a key. You know, does Max Kaiser hold the key? I don't know.
I know. Oh man. Gosh, I wish I told you before we started the podcast, we're going to have a part two and a part three. That's definitely how this feels. I wish I had more time to do even longer today, but this was a really good conversation. I'm so glad we got to do this. We're definitely going to do it again soon, and continue this conversation. Maybe we'll do some Noster focused stuff too, like talking with people who are on Noster and kind of get in with that too. But before we jump off, you know, is there anything else that you wanted to mention to folks? Anywhere to point folks to if they want to get in contact, things like that. Obviously, you mentioned Sunday Afternoon. You're such a brilliant creative and designer, and love what you did, even with, you know, one of our partners and show sponsors, Zeus. Shout out to Zeus. You know, we'll have to do a whole nother episode on Bitcoin marketing. It really is two different conversations too. So I'm glad we focused on this one first.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to talk about that. I mean, you know, the Zeus project we did with Evan was absolutely fantastic. I think just to touch on it real quick, I think the opportunity that we have to tell larger brand stories with Bitcoin brands and Bitcoin products is super, super important for adoption. I think a lot of brands focus necessarily on the product that they are selling, mm-hmm. right? And they're like, but a brand should really think about is the emotional benefit that it provides to the world, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than, you know, the nitty gritty of the product and how it functions. So telling a larger story of the emotional benefit that that brands, you know, bring to the world is something that's going to be hugely important. And it's a lot of stuff that we do at Sunday Afternoon, right? Kind of focusing on telling brand stories and really appealing to an audience. And it's a lot of strategic thinking, a lot of design thinking. And we're excited to bring that to the Bitcoin space for sure. I think Zeus was the first case study. And on when we did the rebrand with a beautiful new logo. I think Evan, you know, shout out to Daniel who put us in touch in the Harlem, Harlem Bitcoin. It was a beautiful story, right? Like we were hosting the Harlem Bitcoin meetup and, you know, Evan was speaking and, you know, we all met and he immediately understood the appeal of having a strong brand. It was great. Great to meet like-minded people and hopefully, you know, we'll keep on doing that for a lot of other Bitcoin brands that are looking for, you know, this level of storytelling and beautiful design, because open source projects don't have to have, you know, bad brands or bad design. I'm not saying that, you know, it necessarily was, but there's we can bring a level of craft and a level of story to open source projects, right? Like I think that's a beautiful thing to do. And something that we're excited to do. The reason why we did it with Zeus is because it kind of ticked all the boxes for me. It's like an open source project. It's you know, it has all these beautiful benefits. But I think it also was mainly for power users, right? And it's like, how do we make this a little bit more accessible? And of course, Evan came in with the Node and the phone and you know, all these amazing technological, like, kind of breakthroughs. But yeah, how do we tell the brand story? So it's something we kind of focus on and made a beautiful logo that hopefully the community loves and likes.
Yeah, I mean, it's killer. It's one of the things that got me looking into Zeus in the first place. And I'm not a super power user. I've played around with Lightning Nodes and running, Lightning Nodes before. And to be quite honest, Daniel on our team loves it. I just don't like running Lightning Nodes. It's a lot of work. I mean, I understand, right? But for me, hearing about, like, I am a LSP node in the phone user of Zeus. And I'm like, that's what I'm here for. I know it does a lot of other stuff. I played around here and there, but that is my daily use, is that. And that functionality is why I use the product first. It's why I reached out to Evan to want to partner on the podcast, because I'm like, you know, I feel like the trade-offs and the balance of security and the options and just the vision and the storytelling, I'm like, this is a cool product. Like, I love using stuff that I can show a normie friend and be like, look how cool this is. Like, it should feel cool. Like, Bitcoin is this new thing. It should not be like, let me show you this website that looked like it was built in 1993. And, you know, oh, but it has all these technical components. They're like I use Cash App every day or whatever.
Right.
So that, I mean, you guys killed it. Like, it is a cool looking product for sure.
That's awesome. I'm glad to hear that, man. I mean, you know, what we were hoping is that, you know, people like you would dig it. Like, that the fact that it, you know, got you interested in it is super amazing. I think there's a lot of people that are coming into space that are thinking about things like this. Lots of creatives, lots of, you know, people that know how to do this and are going to apply it to Bitcoin products. It's going to be absolutely, you know, amazing. I think a lot of that stuff, sadly, was kind of reserved for shitcoins for a long time.
Yeah, very true.
And because they had VC funding and because they had all of this crazy, you know, VC money that they could just throw at designers and throw at creative thinkers. But now it's coming to Bitcoin because, you know, I think a lot of creatives understood the value of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of shitcoin product that got super good branding, these shitcoins died. Like, no.
Yeah, you have to go through a couple of cycles for creators to see. Okay.
No creative wants to make something that's going to die 2 years later.
Yeah.
Like, we want to build something that has a legacy, that, you know, a designer or a creative wants to make a logo that's going to live for 10, 15, 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so there's no appeal in shitcoining at all. What's the value of making something beautiful if it's going to disappear, you know, 18 months down the road? There's none of that.
That's a super good point. And we're going to actually get Evan on the show to talk about Zeus more, talk about, do some lightning stuff too. And I think it'd be good to get you both on the same show. Maybe we can dig a bit deeper.
Oh, hell yeah.
That would be fun. I want to do it in person. If not, we'll do a virtual, but we'll set that up.
We have some little Easter eggs that we could show from the Zeus branding, you know, maybe some killed, some killed logos that never made it. That could be
fun. That'd be fun. Sweet. Well, Ahmed, I'm definitely going to put in the show notes, obviously your website, how to get in touch. And yeah, if you're a Bitcoin brand listening to this, definitely worth it. I mean, check out Sunday Afternoon and what you guys do just in terms of the website, the products. You could see kind of the collaborators, we'll post specifically the Zeus project too, so people can see like what that looked like in the story and the branding. I mean, it's worth it. It got someone like me and many others just looking into the Zeus, and then you're a product user because a lot of us are really interested in like, oh, that's cool, that's fun, like, and bringing that to Bitcoin. And again, I'm not here to have a conversation about ordinals and whatever shitcoin and this and that. It's not about functionality. It's like bringing telling the story of Bitcoin in cool and getting to easy to use products, like things like that for the everyday person is what I'm excited for in this next phase of Bitcoin. And we're seeing it more and more, which is exciting. But is there anything else that you wanted to point out to people or
no,
ways
yeah,
to get in touch?
I mean, you can, you know, follow me on Noster at Lebanese Hodl. You can find my NPub there. And yeah, if you want to, you know, if you have a cool Bitcoin brand, Bitcoin product, reach out. We'd love to help you out. And yeah, I think it's coming for this cycle. I'm excited about it. Thank you for your time. This has been great.
Yeah, thank you so much. And we'll do this again soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Trey.